Hello and welcome everyone back to another episode of The Publisher Lab. I am Tyler Bishop and joined with me today, as you've probably come to expect him, producer Manny.
Hey, good to be back, everybody.
We'll be breaking down the news in digital publishing and going through just about everything that is on the sort of like front page at the moment. And it's no exception that many of the things that you'll hear about are AI, Google, Microsoft related. And one of the things that I do find a little bit interesting is just how relevant some of the big tech players, while the names may be familiar, publishing, I feel like, is experiencing a time where I think it's been very Google heavy for so long. But it's interesting now. I find each week, producer Manny, whenever you start to kind of give us the lay of the land in terms of stories and we start looking at them, you know, I'm seeing more than just Google's name now. Now, Microsoft is not that much different than a Google, but publishers, you know, haven't had a very close relationship with Microsoft for a very long time. So just an observation as I kind of look at our news and agenda for the day. I don't know, has that been something that you've noticed here over the last couple months or so?
Oh, definitely. Microsoft has definitely come back into the forefront. I think at the start of the year with AI becoming such a big deal in the tech industry, a lot of players kind of threw their hat into the ring. I remember that expression now. We had a big problem with that expression last week, but I know it now. So now we have more people just really fighting to kind of get ahead in the AI race. So we're starting to see all these major companies kind of coming back into the news and becoming a big deal. And I think it's really important for publishers to kind of keep up with all of these big tech companies who are making all these brand new innovations.
Yeah, Microsoft, the classic, the little engine that could, you know? It is interesting to me though. And one of the things that I think is probably I feel like we're about that time where right when it seems like the parties or the players within a space seem like they can't go anywhere, there's nobody new coming in, these are the players of the game. It's right about that time that somebody comes in and sort of shakes things up a little bit. ChatGPT, I guess you could make the argument that OpenAI is certainly one of these. I could imagine probably one or two others. I would say that history says that it's almost a near certainty. So it will be interesting to see how things shake out over the next couple, probably a year or two, when you start to think about threats of new entry. But speaking of our good friends at Google, they've got something new in their search labs. So tell us a little bit more about it.
Sure. Yeah. Google has a lot of new things coming up. Google has a lot of new things that they're definitely experimenting with. They're introducing a new way to enrich your search experience. They're calling it Notes, which is an innovative experiment that's coming out of the Google Search Labs. This feature allows users to add their own insights to search results, offering a blend of expert and everyday knowledge right at your fingertips. Whether it's tips, advice, or personal stories, Notes aims to make your search results more informative and relatable. To dive into this new world of enriched search, you gotta simply opt into the experiment in the Google app. You'll find the Notes button at the bottom of the search results where you can creatively express your thoughts using text, stickers, photos, and a variety of visual styles. Google is committed to ensuring these contributions are safe, helpful, and relevant with a combination of algorithmic protections and human moderation. It's currently available in the US in English and in Hindi and English in India. From the looks of it, it's kind of like a comment system, which is really paying credence to what you said a few months ago, that publishers are going to have to look at digital publishing the same way social media influencers are looking at influencing online.
Yeah, and it's funny because those types of predictions are, I feel like, a dime a dozen. But that's one that I felt pretty strongly about. And I would say we've definitely seen evidence that is 100% the shift that's occurring. Whether this is wanted by users or not, I think you can look at, you know, the recent studies that they've done. I think Search Engine Land did one where they were looking at, it doesn't appear that ChatGPT or OpenAI is actually stealing market share from Google. So users aren't shifting away from Google. It doesn't look like they're bleeding or suffering from user attrition. So Google is still going to have the flexibility to be able to sort of like dictate to the market what they want. And you've seen the follow this publisher, follow this website feature, a couple months ago. And now you have this, which you're right. It essentially turns the search results page into a little bit more of like a Facebook style news feed. Now, this is in labs. I would go and take a look at this to get an idea of like kind of what it looks like. It's at, you can go to blog.google.com or type in search labs to Google search, and I'm sure it's the first result. Funny how that works. And I think that you'll find that it, you know, those that have been around a while will probably look at this and go, I see a Google trying to bring back Google Plus. Nice try. But this is quite a bit different. This has been something that, you know, I was talking to you and a couple of our other team members yesterday. You know, I think the dream 20 years ago was everybody looked at MySpace and Facebook, who was coming along. And it was like, these guys won't be around very long because the open web will become social media. You'll have your email address and then both websites. Everybody will have a website and you will put, you know, news and information up on there. And basically the open web would serve as this sort of platform for everybody. And it was this very communal sort of like utopian idea of what social media could be. And this is not that, but it does sort of like take a step towards, if you do want an equitable internet, what you would want is essentially an open web that nobody owns that would basically serve as, you know, access to search, social media, people, and all the services and utilities and stuff like that that exist online. So, I'm not anti-Google in this respect. I'm skeptical of whether or not this is something that users want from Google, who they're going to just view as a search engine. But I see this being having more local probably applications, first of all. And I think that our audience and publishers will probably hear that part of it and be like, aw, you know, because I think it does limit some of the opportunity for them. But yeah, I would say this is probably just the first of a lot to come if they can get any traction with some of this stuff. So I would just, this is something we'll follow closely. So I'd encourage our publishers listening to do the same, because it certainly is interesting. It would make for one of the biggest shifts in Google search in a long time. And speaking of Google search, they're back in the news. They're a classic case. I feel like it's almost like a soap opera at this point. And now enter one of our characters from earlier in our podcast, Microsoft. Tell us more.
Yeah, so in a significant development in the tech world, Microsoft CEO Satya Nadella has taken the stand in Google's ongoing antitrust trial. And Nadella's testimony brought to light the deepening rift between the two tech giants. He accused Google of employing tactics that not only hindered Microsoft's search engine, but also stifled competition in a rapidly evolving AI sector. Google, on the other hand, has defended its position, highlighting Microsoft's efforts to push Bing's search engine through through Windows computers. This conflict has been rooted in long-standing grievances about Microsoft's market dominance and is now spilling over into the AI industry. Where both companies are major players, the rivalry that dates back to the early days of the internet has seen various phases, including a brief period of attempted resolution in 2016. However, in the recent months, we've seen more escalation in lobbying efforts and complaints, signaling a renewed and intense competition that could shape the future of the tech industry. And I think that this has definitely been more heightened with the involvement of AI. We've been talking all year how Google Bard is definitely behind the Bing search and Bing chat. Now, granted that I haven't really used Bing chat a lot in like my daily usage, I have definitely started to use more of the ChatGPT plugin where you'll just search a website using Bing. And I'm going to be honest, I downloaded Bing. I haven't installed it, but I downloaded it. So I think that's like a good first step into saying,
yeah, well, they counted you a million times in some kind of report that says how many users have downloaded or something like that.
It's baby steps.
You know, to me, this part of the story is it's reminiscent of, you know, the steroid era and the Tour de France, where, you know, you have, you know, everybody's like, I can't believe Lance Armstrong was on steroids the whole time. And it's like, they were all on steroids. You know, it's like these other, guys that were riders were on steroids too, and they were the ones that were trying to get up on a high horse. And I find it quite interesting because both of these companies are doing the exact same behaviors and activities. They even have partnerships with each other in different arms of business where they're essentially doing this to others. You know, you can look at something like, you know, like mobile phones and different things like that, where, you know, you have them working together, or, you know, they're more competitive than not in most of their different business channels, but that just happens to be for right now. It's like they generally have not got along super great. But that's all these tech giants, because they're all just trying to box each other out. And the thing with Google that was the revelation this week in a court testimony, someone on Google seemed let it slip that the terms of the deal that they have with Apple was, you know, we know certain like amounts of money, but we don't know under what circumstances they were paid that or for what. And it's 36% is what the gentleman said under testimony this week. And that was like eye opening. And Google was trying really hard to not get that released publicly. They wanted that suppressed and the judge wouldn't do it. And so that's significant. 36% of all iOS revenue is they, you know, I think in Nadella's testimony, I think one of the other things he mentioned was that amount of money is by far enough for Apple to say, we're not going to build the search engine. And that's all you would theoretically have to prove in this case to highlight that this was antitrust, is that if Google strategically, maybe is a better word, you know, paid Apple that much to be the default search engine on iOS devices, for the sole purpose of basically eliminating them as competition. So Apple not building a search engine, that theoretically stifles competition, because maybe Apple can build a better search engine, and maybe that has, you know, benefits and cost reductions for consumers, because it creates more competition in the ad market, who knows. But either way, you know, the amount of money, I mean, it's significant. It is to the degree to where it's like, if Apple was to build a search engine down the road, the benefits and the money that you would make, you know, if it all goes well, still might not equal that amount of money. So it's almost against their best interest at that point to even think about building a search engine, which it changes everything for the industry too, because you think about it, it's like, you know, I think for a long time, people have predicted that Apple would get into the search business for that reason. And Siri looked like maybe the first step to that, but they've never moved much further or expressed any interest in that. And I think now we know, you know, a couple billion reasons why.
Just a couple billion.
Just a few.
But we also still have Microsoft in the news, because we got a story coming from entrepreneur.com that says Microsoft replaced its news editors with AI. And it's brought one disaster after another. What could go wrong? In a move towards modernization, Microsoft replaced human editors with AI to curate news on platforms like MSN.com and Microsoft Start. However, this shift has led to a series of unfortunate events. The AI, lacking discernment of human editors, has published stories from dubious sources, spreading misinformation and sparking controversy. This approach, initiated after the layoff of many of the human editors in 2020, has backfired and attracted criticism from respected publications.
Yeah, you're doing it wrong, Microsoft.
Mm-hmm. A notable incident involved The Guardian, which expressed its displeasure in a letter to Microsoft after an insensitive poll was attached to a sensitive news story.
I like the description, insensitive poll, insensitive news story. Mm-hmm.
In response, Microsoft is taking corrective measures, including disabling all polls on news articles and conducting a thorough investigation to prevent such errors in the future. This situation highlights the challenges and limitations of relying solely on AI for tasks requiring nuance and judgment and sensitivity, which has definitely been a big theme in some of the news articles that I've been reading, where they're talking about, can we get AI to be empathetic? Can we teach them when they should kind of make these judgment decisions and what's right and what's wrong? But what do you think? Do you think we're going to be able to get to that point?
Yeah, no doubt. It's just a matter of like, what's the flavor? I mean, machines can do whatever it is that you want them to do. The reason why this is like backwards, like to me, this is a very like sort of like, I'm surprised. Microsoft's a mature organization, and they're supposed to be a leader in this sector. And, you know, this seems like a pretty big sort of like, yeah, like faux pas from the standpoint of AI, you don't want to be your editor. You don't want it to be your CEO. You don't want it to be the person in charge yet, maybe. You want it to be the one that's the workhorse. And Microsoft got it backwards here, where while theoretically it seems like, yeah, a machine could systemically do the same job as an editor or somebody that's a human, you think about the nuance of being able to glean through the news. I mean, just, you know, to pick a sensitive topic on a sensitive subject without being insensitive, producer Manny, the war in Israel right now, between Israel's like sort of like invasion of the Gaza Strip and everything that's going on there, is hot of a topic as that is. There's not one news source that I read and I go, I got it. I know exactly what's going on, and I have a really good, unbiased picture with all the information that I need to know everything that I need to know about that. Of course not. I look at that and I'm like, wow, this is a really, really politically, emotionally, fundamentally, like your values are tied into things like this. And so this is something where it's like, you know, I could read 1,000 news sources and I might be able to pick out some that are better than others, but I still might not feel like I get a complete picture of everything that would allow me to well round my worldview around sort of like what's going on there. And so with that being said, that's a very human thing. And it's also subjective by person. And there's all these other things too, where it's like the environment, you know, you always hear somebody say like, come on, man, read the room. You know, it's like, you might publish a news story on something, but the timing just sucks. You know what I mean? It's like, it's like there's certain times whenever a news story about, you know, like peace in the Middle East or something like that, you could publish like a editorial piece about that, about some kind of like, you know, smart, witty economic, you know, take. But right now it's not the time, Bob, you know? And I think that AI, that's the thing it's really poor at now is that. And it doesn't have the mechanisms now to read sort of like global sentiments and things like that. So with that being said, it was put in a job that it wasn't, you know, ready for. AI is a lot like people. Like I said, you want to hire it to be the young up and comer right now that's, you know, working late and putting in the extra hours, writing content and combing through stuff and finding, you know, hunting out the bias and editing. But you don't want to like immediately promote that person to the editor in chief. That's still a job for humans for now, especially when it comes to news. So yeah, big misstep there by Microsoft. And speaking of missteps, what kind of podcast would it be if we didn't get into what X has changed here recently? And I was telling you before the podcast, this one wasn't a surprise to me. And I think, the reason why may surprise some of our users, but I'll let you tell them a little bit more before I dive into it.
Sure thing. So we're getting a news story from techcrunch.com where it says Elon Musk says that X is changing its algorithm to highlight smaller accounts. X is on the brink of a significant transformation under the leadership of Elon Musk, and the platform is set to roll out a major algorithmic update. This change is designed to bring smaller creators into the spotlight, showcasing their content to users beyond their immediate network. The update aligns with X's vision to evolve into a creator-centric platform, offering features like extended posts, enhanced video uploads, and an ad revenue sharing program. This shift aims to empower creators, providing them with new avenues to grow their audience and monetize their content directly on X. Additionally, the platform is enhancing creator-fan interactions with features like message requests and audio-video calling. While the success of this new algorithm remains to be seen, especially in the face of competition from established platforms like YouTube and TikTok, X is committed to making the update open source for ongoing improvements. So we'll definitely be seeing what Twitter is going to be doing over the next couple of months with this transformation. And initially I thought like, oh, this is another kind of panic to try to get more people back on the platform, but you had a completely different outlook on this.
Yeah. So this is an old playbook, and it's one from Google's book. So I was sharing with you and some of the team members, you know, one of Google's biggest threats they identified over a decade ago was that the open web, basically a browser-based internet, where instead of using apps or phones or other mechanisms to like interact with the, you know, the world and the world of information, that they heavily relied on the fact that people would use the, you know, file-based system of using a browser, putting in a file name extension, a URL, and accessing websites. And because a search engine is paramount to that, being able to find things. And they realized that if they reinforced, basically, let's say the majority of internet traffic went to 100 websites, if those 100 websites stop being relevant, or they decide we're just going to go pure app, we're not even going to focus on websites, our app experience is better, that would put Google in a pretty tough spot. So it's in Google's best interest and the open web's best interest if whenever you search for something, you are essentially finding something different every time. You're not always landing on the Wall Street Journal. You're getting information. You're finding answers from as many different sources as possible. And this makes Google's search business and the open web stronger. When you think about it, it's like, so that way, if the New York Times or the Washington Post decides we're not going to have a website anymore, or they do something, you know, silly and the world goes, I'm going to boycott them, or, you know, they go out of business or you name it, you know, it doesn't change the, you know, sort of value of a search engine. So you have Google, who now has a risk of, you know, these 100 businesses, if anything happens to them, it weakens our business. Well, by having, you know, traffic go to millions, if not hundreds of millions of websites instead, you know, one of those goes out of business, Google doesn't even notice. I mean, literally millions could go out of business and Google, it wouldn't affect the value of their business. So X is the same thing. So if you think about it right now, what if like the top 10% of X users, you know, journalists and media folks, if they all just said, well, right now we've had it, we're going to Mastodon, we're going to Blue Sky. To me, this is sort of like a hedge against the fact that like something like a Blue Sky, where you have someone like Jack Dorsey, who was the founder of Twitter, you know, if he was to do some kind of stunt Elon Musk style and pull away 10% of Twitter users, that would pretty significantly, I would say, hinder the platform. If all of a sudden, you know, 50% of the people that maybe you follow for news and information are now gone, you know, you may not come back to X, or maybe you couldn't log into your account, and now that's just the final straw, you know, still can't log in. And it to me, this is a no-brainer, and this is Elon probably getting a little bit more practical, actually, and kind of looking at X and saying, okay, I've done a lot of the sort of like sort of majorly disruptive things to see if I could move the needle. I need to maybe focus less on one big thing that kind of blows it up, to like focus on what are all the little things that are the fundamentals that maybe I can do to keep this platform like growing.
Definitely. And with him being under so much scrutiny over the last year with with X losing so much value.
Silly, I think. It's only been Twitter for over a decade.
I mean, you know, it's still going to take a lot of getting used to for us to stop calling it that. But with him having so much scrutiny, and the government also asking him to testify on Twitter or on X as well, we're going to see what's going to end up happening ultimately. But keeping with Elon Musk, but moving on to AI news, Elon Musk presented a bold new prediction for the future, and he called it an age of abundance, where advanced AI and robotics revolutionize our world. Within the next 25 years, Musk envisions a society transformed by digital superintelligence and sophisticated robotics. In the future, uncomfortable, dangerous, or tedious jobs are going to be handled by robots, freeing humans to explore new interests and passions. Musk's vision extends beyond mere technological advancement. He foresees a societal shift where the concept of traditional work may become obsolete, especially in countries that embrace AI and automation. This new era could lead to what Musk described as universal high income, with most goods and services available at little to no cost, except for the unique items like art and real estate. While the vision shares some similarities with socialism, it raises critical questions about resource control and societal structure. Despite his futuristic outlook, Musk acknowledges the personal challenges of aligning this vision with his current work-driven lifestyle. He emphasized the importance of maintaining motivation and a sense of purpose in the rapid evolving world where AI and robotics increasingly take on human roles. This age of abundance presents a fascinating glimpse into what the future of capitalism might hold, as envisioned by one of the most influential tech leaders in the world. And this is definitely giving off Jetson vibes for sure.
Yeah. And I would say, you know, Elon Musk is channeling, you know, ideas of times past. If you look at the last story, said they took a page out of Google's book. This is, you could go back, I'm sure you could go back to right before the Industrial Revolution, and people were saying the exact same thing. And I think I mentioned to you before this podcast, you know, the innovation of AI and the revolution that I think that will, so we've had a computer technology like exponential curve of change and innovation and progress over the last 50 to 100 years, really 50 years. Maybe you could even condense that even smaller and say we've probably over the last 20 has been the most significant portion of that, but it's been exponential. And because of that, I think we have a tendency to ignore the fact that many other areas of human existence have not evolved anywhere close. So software and computer technology has improved so much that, you know, life is far more convenient in many ways because we've used technology to plug a lot of holes. But you look at the science, you look at biological science or biotech. And while there's some really interesting things that you could, you know, project out into the future and say, wow, this could be game changing, you know, like we still treat most things the same way that we did before. We just do it a little bit better. Not the same expense. Like if you go tear your ACL right now, you know, I tore my ACL in my left knee 20 years ago. They cut my knee open. They cut out part of my patellar tendon, and then they drilled a hole through the bone and they put that back in there. They still do that today. Now you can heal a little bit faster. Sometimes they'll use a cadaver ligament or something like that, but it's like still the same thing. They're just doing it slightly differently. And it's been that way for, you know, another 50 years. So you have one area where it's not, you know, you're not really doing anything different, but then you look at something like communication and computer technology. You think about how you communicated 40 years ago, 30 years ago. It's like, if I wanted to hear your voice, Manny, like you and I both needed to know where we were going to both be at the same time. And then you had to, you know, call me on the phone and then I'd have to answer it. And yeah, all the limitations of all that. And then now it's like, I could reach you through like 100 different mechanisms wherever you are in the world.
Right.
Especially now too, it's like I get on a plane and I don't even think twice. My mobile carrier has got some kind of plan to where it's like, I don't even incur major data costs when I go to other countries now. So it's like, you know, just even over the last 3 or 4 years, that's changed again. And I think we're going to see the exact same sort of innovation now because our computer technology innovation is bumping up against limitations in energy consumption and energy production. So, the chips themselves, Microsoft announced this week that all their data centers are going to make their own chips through ARM. And these are going to be designed specifically for artificial intelligence because they're more efficient, because AI based computing takes about 10x the amount of energy. And that's a lot of heat that those that produces as well. And so the, those chips have their own limitations as to like even just how efficient they can be. So we're going to need to make both hardware and energy-based innovations to fuel our desire for innovation on the AI side. And these things have a cost. I think Elon's idea here that this is going to be all like great is trickle down sort of thinking. And I think we've proven over time that there are principles in that, that that are true, but at the same time, it's not, it's never this utopian thing. It's like any of these sort of like large, bigger picture socio-political visions, whether it's communism or capitalism or you know, innovation, these things all have their weaknesses because they can be exploited. And I think if you look over the course of human history, innovation in any area, you know, like Elon doesn't want there to be this to get regulated down. He doesn't want to stifle innovation, and he's promising that the world will all benefit. Everyone will benefit, but there will be bodies. And one of the things we've seen with innovation is the those at the forefront, they get exponentially richer and exponentially like out sort of, they outpace everyone else by a significant degree. You think about the railroads and, you know, who were the railroad barons back in the day. You know, the families that were associated with that today, even to this day, are just, I mean, like unfathomably wealthy. And it's generational, and it's because they get such a huge lead with something like this. And I think you can look at this industry and say, well, AI doesn't necessarily, it's not special in that regard. So I don't see where, you know, it would be any different than what we've seen in innovation past. And also, he mentions robotics here a lot. I mean, robotics is completely separate from AI. You can give robots AI software, but that doesn't change the fact that we don't have a robot today that can go to the grocery store or a manufacturing plant and then do that job for free. I would imagine like those are companies that need to be formed and lots of R&D that needs to be conducted. These robots don't exist today. So I don't see why AI, you know, creates this entire robotics industry that he somehow is like glossed over and said, you know, like roped into AI here. I think it's pie in the sky thinking, and I think it probably serves his interests, and that's why he's talking about it this way.
It's going to be interesting to see how this develops. I mean, don't get me wrong, I would love for a robot to be able to walk my dog so I don't have to do it.
Well, they made robot dogs first, so maybe it'll walk you know.
That's a great point. But something that might become a big problem for Elon Musk in his vision for the age of abundance is the fact that, you know, AI just costs so much money. It just guzzles energy, and it's going to be something that they're going to have to tackle in the future. And we got a story coming from the Wall Street Journal that says AI's power guzzling habits drive search for alternative energy sources, because in a rapidly advancing world of artificial intelligence, companies like Amazon, Microsoft, and Google are facing a new challenge where the soaring energy demands of AI models such as ChatGPT are just becoming so high. These tech giants are now on the quest for alternative energy sources to power their data centers, with AI's appetite for electricity potentially reaching 3.5% of the global use by 2030. The pressure is on to find sustainable solutions. Innovators such as Curso Energy Systems are stepping up, transforming flared gas from oil production into power source for data centers, thereby reducing methane emissions and easing the burden on electrical grids. The race is on to harness wind, solar, geothermal, and even nuclear energy to meet the needs of these data-hungry AI models. As companies like Google explore cutting-edge options like advanced nuclear and geothermal energy, the goal is clear: to secure a clean, reliable energy supply for the future of AI. With investments in nuclear fission startups and the development of mini nuclear reactors, the tech world is pushing the boundaries of what's possible in energy generation. And that's going to be, it's interesting to see where there was a lot of pushback on getting green and sustainable and reliable energy, but now tech is really pushing forward to try to get us these new resources just to power these AI systems.
I'm not going to be the first one that tells you or make a prediction that, you know, the next great curve of innovation will be in energy. You can go and look around, and this has been predicted by a lot of people. And the reason why is because there's just so much evidence that we're on the verge of that. So whether it's nuclear fusion or innovation in how we, because I mean, realistically in the state of California, I think 20% of the power that we generate, we dump off into the ocean or ground out at the end of the day, every day, because we produce too much power. We can't store it. And that comes from the cyclical, you know, weather patterns and how wind energy, basically like energy usage is at its lowest point in the middle of the afternoon, but energy production is at the highest because that's whenever the wind goes through the wind farms and stuff like that here. So we have all this excess power and we can't distribute it because the grid's not good enough. So we have this energy storage issue, which green energy is slightly easier to store in some regards. Natural gas is really, like, we've had a lot of innovation there, and you have this liquefaction of natural gas, but it's projected that by 2030 that we'll have an abundance of power alone just from green energy. And we have innovation now taking place in storage and different things like that. But all of this stems from two things, and you see it across everything. You could find out all these instances in your own lives or in things that you've seen across the world over the course of your lifetime. And it's that when the major players are affected in some way, or you kind of, like they always say, like deadlines make deals. You know, like once it gets to be crunch time, magically how all the problems resolve and the challenges go away. So Apple is the richest company that's ever existed in history by, I mean, you know, like you'd have to adjust for inflation, but they are by far the richest company in history. And so now, to keep up with innovation that's occurring and to continue to produce their products and stay on top, they're going to need innovation in the energy sector. That said, we also have a lot of global conflict now. And a lot of this is, you could argue, most of it is over access to resources. Who has what deals and what countries are friendly with each other, where we dig these minerals out of the ground that are so necessary for all these technologies. Same thing for energy. Where do we get the majority of our energy? If it's coal or oil or natural gas, where are we getting that from? And are we able to access that freely and without sort of like basically getting shaken down? And how equitable is that? And so if we can have a form of energy that we can essentially modulate, like a fusion, where we can produce it on demand and as needed, and it's incredibly cost efficient, and then we can make innovation headway in terms of both chips and storage power. So you have a chip now that, you know, like it isn't subject to, you know, some of the restrictions that we have now, where it's not overheating at a certain point where it can't be used or has to be modulated so it doesn't consume so much power, or even is more efficient at using that power, and the power itself is cheaper and more accessible, then all of a sudden these problems go away. And I would say if you look out at those areas that where we're pioneering new, you know, mechanisms, there's incredible amounts of investment there. All the people that had investments in AI early on, they've all shifted the money to those locations. And classic statement, follow the money. And I think you kind of can get a pretty well-rounded picture of where we're going to go in that regard. So I don't see this as being something that is existential threat or challenge. I would say it's more of a prediction on where we probably will be most impressed with human innovation over the next 10 years.
Oh, most definitely. And I did not have AI leading to new reliable sources of energy on my bingo card this year.
I know, you know, but if you had, you know, we'd probably both be much richer individuals, because we'd be reading sort of the tea leaves. And I have a feeling that somebody did, and those are very those individuals were probably fairly well off before they got that bingo card.
Oh, definitely. But that concludes the stories that we got for this week on the docket. Thanks again for joining us on another episode of the Publisher Lab. If you want to read more from us or watch past episodes, you can go to publisherlab.org. If you are watching this on the day that it comes out and it's before dinner time and you're in the United States, happy Thanksgiving. If it's after the fact, because I don't expect you to watch this on Thanksgiving. What was your favorite dish from Thanksgiving? I want to know.
Are you a like, what's yours, Producer Manny?
I'm a big sucker for cranberry sauce.
Really? Yeah, oh, man, it's my least favorite.
Really? No, yeah. I do mine homemade with some crushed pineapple in there. Ooh, it's one of my favorite go-tos.
I have a feeling you probably do it really well. I used to not be a big fan of like the traditional American Thanksgiving fare. But here recently I've kind of gotten away. Like, I grew up in Missouri, and so it was like, yeah, a lot of really old timey dishes and stuff, like this stuff, casseroles and whatnot, not my thing. But since I've moved to California, we've been doing, you know, we've been celebrating sort of like the holiday with friends and stuff like that. And surprisingly enough, we have a lot of friends that are Brazilian. And while they don't celebrate it in Brazil, they embrace the holiday here. And man, I love Brazilian food. So my paradigm is shifting a little bit, but in a non-traditional sort of like direction. But yeah, I'm interested in our listeners as well that celebrate the holiday. It'd be cool to hear what everyone's favorite is. And that's it. Anything else, Producer Manny?
No, I think we covered it.
All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll catch you next time on another episode of The Publisher Lab.